Come visit and talk, and it's a real pleasure to be here. And Perimeter is one of my favorite places to visit. I wish I could stay longer, but it is what it is. So let me start by giving you sort of an outline of what I'm going to say and talk about some motivation. So this is, I'll begin, talk about what the general problem is, why we care about it, what we hope to do with it. And a large part of this is going to be studying what I'll call heavy light correlators. Okay, these are correlation functions in conformal field theories, as well as we'll see not just the correlators themselves, but also the conformal blocks which contribute to them. And I'll say more about what the heavy light limit is, but basically you can think of it as just a probe limit. So it's a limit where some operators probe other, act as a probe of other operators. Okay, and I'll tell you what we learn from looking at this limit. One of the things we're going to learn is that we can study very energetic states and see what they look like. And in the large C limit, they actually behave as if they are thermal backgrounds. Okay, so this is one of the main punchlines of studying large C CFTs in two dimensions and looking at this specific probe limit. We get to learn something about what very energetic eigenstates look like. Okay, and this has very important consequences. The fact that we can see that they look like not pure states, but they look like thermal states at large central charge. In particular, this tells us something about if we look at one over C corrections versus what we can think of as non-perturbative corrections. Okay, so the fact that they look thermal in some sense persists to all orders in one over C corrections. Okay. And this actually creates a very sharp problem. Okay, so I'll talk about what this problem is, but it has to do with the fact that related to black hole information loss, that black holes look like thermal backgrounds, and that's related to the fact that in semi-classical gravity, information is destroyed. Okay, and we can see this at the level of CFT correlation functions in a 1 over C expansion. Okay, since we're talking about unitary CFTs, we know that there has to be something which comes in beyond perturbation theory to restore unitarity. And these are going to be the non-perturbatively small, what I'll call E minus C corrections. Okay, and so a large part of this talk is going to be about understanding sort of the role of how one over C terms behave and how non-perturbatively small terms, how we can actually look at them and see something about how they can actually restore unitarity when we go beyond the semi-classical limit. Okay, so this is basically the main punchline of this talk, is that unitarity is violated in 1 over C perturbation theory. Okay, this is just a statement about how CFTs behave. And then we can actually look at non-perturbatively small effects and how they're related to the restoration of unitarity when we go beyond the semi-classical limit. Okay? All right.
Liam?
Yes?
Everything you're going to say, though, is in the context of like a four-point function, is that right?
In this talk, it'll all be in the context of a four-point function. That's correct. Yes. So not that intrinsically it has to be a four-point function. People have looked at more general correlation functions, but the four-point function is sort of the simplest one you can look at where the problem shows up. Okay. All right. Okay, very good. So that's my outline. That's where we're going. So let me start way back, say some sort of very general words about the motivation and the setup. Okay. Many of you know this motivation very well, but never hurts to say it again. So really, what we're after is What AdS-CFT is supposed to be, it's supposed to tell us how to go from CFT to a complete non-perturbative description of gravity. Okay, so we really want to see how this, turn this into. We really want to turn this into practical calculations. We want to extract from the CFT actual non-perturbative effects in quantum gravity. So we know they're there. The question is, how do we get at them? Okay, and in this respect, AdS-3 CFT2 is, in my opinion, a really perfect toy model. Okay, it has all the things that we want in a toy model. So it actually has the physics that we're really interested in. That is to say, AdS-3 gravity actually has black holes. Okay, honest to goodness black holes. Therefore, it really has an information paradox. Okay. So the problem is really, it's already there in AdS-3, okay? And that's great because we have way more tools available to us in CFT2. So as you probably know, the main reason is that the conformal symmetry in two dimensions is actually infinite, unlike in higher dimensions. And so that gives us much more power and many more tools at our disposal than in higher dimensions. Okay? So I think, even if you're very interested in AdS gravity in higher dimensions, I think this is a really great place to start, because any problem that you want to address in AdS-CFT in general, I think it's going to be easier in AdS-3 CFT2. So this is a great place to start. And I think it's very likely that, the physics of how the information paradox is resolved is probably not qualitatively different in three dimensions versus high dimensions. All right, so that's what we want to do. We don't just want to look at any old CFT, okay? We need to look at CFTs with large central charge. So there's a very simple way of saying why that is. Basically, we want AdS theories which have a lot of space compared to the Planck length. All right, so we have some short Planck length. And you can think of AdS as a box, where the size of the box is essentially set by the radius of curvature. And we want this size to be much bigger than the Planck length itself. Okay, so we just want a large separation of scales here. This ratio, LAdS divided by L Planck, is proportional to the central charge. Okay, this is due to work by Brown and Hano almost a decade before the discovery of AdS-CFT. And so we want to look at large central charge CFTs. Okay? All right. So that's what we're going to be focusing on. Now, we want to learn about certain kinds of problems related to the information paradox in non-perturbative gravity. And for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to divide these problems into sort of two classes, which I'll call easy and hard. Okay? So let me tell you what I mean by that. So there are sort of, I would like to divide up these puzzles into sort of two categories. And I'm going to call the problem quote unquote easy. Of course, they're still not actually easy, but they're easier. These are ones where we may not know exactly how to compute what happens from CFTs. We may not know all the answers, but at least we know in principle how to sharply define what the question is in terms of CFT correlators. Okay, so if you came and handed us a CFT, which we knew exactly, we would at least know exactly what to look at. Okay, so these are problems where we know how to define the problem. Oops. We know how to define it in terms of CFT correlators. Okay? So this is easier, in a concrete sense. If someone came along and invented a powerful enough computer tomorrow, you could just feed n equals 4 super Yang mills to it. Or a D1, D5 at strong coupling, and the computer could spit out the answer because you know exactly what question you want to tell it to answer. Okay? And this talk is only going to be about these sort of easier kinds of questions. And then in contrast to that, there are still questions in ADS-CFT, which I'll call hard, and they're just everything else. Okay? All right. So there are many interesting questions that fall into this category. Okay? For example, these are things like the question of firewalls, what happens to inside a black hole, what happens, why is physics behind the horizon well described by effective field theory? Is it well described by effective field theory or not? So it's still not entirely clear, even if you knew all the correlators in the CFT, whether or not you could extract this information. Okay. All right. So I'm going to be focusing on ones where all we have to do is compute the CFT correlators. Okay. Very good. So what kind of questions are these? Let me start by going back, 15 years already, to one question of this form presented by Maldacena in 2001 related to the violation of unitarity in black holes as compared to CFT correlators. All right. So this was the question that he set up. He said, let's look at, we'll take an eternal black hole, okay? And let's compare this to what we should get from CFT. And it's important that it's on a finite size circle. And if we're sitting around with some black hole it's in, because the walls of ADS are like a mirror, it very quickly comes into equilibrium with its radiation. And so the whole system is in equilibrium. There's a bath of thermal whatever sitting around. And one thing you can do to the system is you can just take whatever your favorite source is, and you can hit the system at the boundary, and you can disturb the system, okay? And so you can hit this with your favorite source, which is gonna be some operator, okay, at some time t equals zero. And then you can wait a while, and you can use the same operator. You can measure what that operator sees at some later time t, okay? And so this is basically a question of what is a two-point function of this operator in the black hole background. Okay? And what you find in semi-classical gravity is that as time goes on, this two-point function just decays. So this is t, this is this two-point function. It just decays exponentially. Okay? All right, and importantly, it decays forever. And so eventually we lose the information that we pinged it at some early time. Okay? This is in contrast to what should be possible in a unitary CFT. So in a unitary CFT, we can ping the system. It's a CFT on some finite region of space, and so you know that the effect of that ping can sort of diffuse throughout the entire space-time. But eventually, because we're on a finite-sized circle, there sort of spreads out as much as it possibly can. And so it can't spread out anymore. And so it can decay exponentially at early times. But at some point, it should stop. Okay, and at that point, it can do whatever. It might just flatten out. It might come back up. It might wiggle. But it shouldn't decay. It shouldn't decay forever to infinity. Okay. All right. So the way we can summarize this is this looks like unitarity is violated in perturbation theory and gene theory, okay, in the semi-classical limit. And if you do perturbations around the semi-classical limit, it looks like unitarity is violated. And this is a concrete thing that we can diagnose by looking at correlation functions in a CFT. Okay?
So what's the connection between unitarity and the decay of the correlator at early times?
Yeah, the connection is if it's a unitary CFT, then the information, so it can't decay away forever. Okay.
These are groups. What's the mathematical statement?
What's the mathematical statement that the two-point function can't decay forever? So this is basically just set up. I'm going to talk about a precise correlation function in a second, and then I'll say, in that case, it'll be a very precise statement.
This is CFT at finite temperature, right?
Yeah.
And this means you're coupled to a heat bath, and things can disappear into the heat bath.
What can I say? So if it's really a CFT, a unitary CFT, there should be a finite number of total degrees of freedom. And so it shouldn't be able to decay entirely into the degrees. It shouldn't be able to decay entirely away. Okay. Let me define the correlation function that I'm actually going to study. This is mostly just prelude. Okay. Good. Okay. So, right? Can I? Is there an easy way to make this go up? Front. Excellent. Okay. So, all right. So to answer your question, I'm actually going to be in this talk discussing something different, which is very similar. What I'm going to be doing is not looking at a thermal bath, but I'm going to be looking at a background of a pure state and very high energy, okay? Okay. So I want to emphasize this is a high energy pure state. Okay. So it's not, say it one more time, it's not a thermal bath. And I'm calling a high energy, okay, so that's sort of using ADS language for the CFT. To be more precise, it's really a high dimension operator, right? So energies in ADS are dimensions in the CFT. So really, this state is the state that's created by some very heavy operator, so very high dimension operator, sorry, acting at the origin, okay? And I'm mostly going to be focusing for simplicity on the case where it's a primary operator, okay? Since all other operators you can get in terms of primary operators, okay? So we'll see that there are some problems which can be more sharply stated in terms of this, and also this type of quantity is more amenable to bootstrap techniques, okay? All right, so this is the thing that we're actually going to be considering. Now, let me say a little bit more precisely what the probe limit is.
Maybe it's related to Farrell's question. So when you look at the correlator like that, so
yes.
Strictly speaking, now you look at the isolated CFT, right? That's a CFT that's not coupled to a thermal bath.
That's right.
As well. So it's a different, in principle, it can be different problem.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yes, that's right. It's not, this is a different quantity. It's, you
so
know,
it's indeed.
It's closely related, but it's different. And in fact, some of its properties are different, okay? And some of the problems are sharp for this.
Right.
Thing.
So that's an important thing is that it's an isolated CFT.
Yes.
It doesn't couple to anything else. All the evolution is. Yeah, so in other words, it would be a microcanonical ensemble if it would be as opposite to a canonical ensemble.
That's right. Yeah.
So if the system is unitary and the dynamics is, let's say, ergodic, then this guy will certainly decay, but never reaches to zero. But I think it's very small, like order of e to the minus s or something.
You're saying it can decay to be very small, just not all the way to zero, and so it'll decay to something like e to the minus c.
It's very, very small, I guess.
It can decay to something very small.
Yeah, I think it's
yeah.
Order one.
So the the bigger the system is, the smaller it can decay to. But we're exactly interested in very small effects. Okay. All right. So I said I was going to look at these things in a probe limit. Okay. So let me just say a little bit more sharply what I mean by that. So we're taking the limit that C is much greater than 1. And in reference to Rob's question, we don't have to look at just four-point functions. In general, we can talk about a probe limit for any number of operators. Okay? The important point is that there's some number of operators which I'll call light operators or probes. And what I mean by that is the scaling dimension of these guys is very small compared to the central charge. Okay? That's the definition, my definition of light operators. Okay? On the other hand, we have other operators in the correlation function, which I'll call heavy, and these basically create a background that the probe operators see. And heavy operators are just defined by, as I take C to infinity, the heavy operators scale like some number of times C. Okay?
Are you also assuming that there is anything in between? Mm-hmm.
You mean something that scales like root C?
Yeah.
Something that scales like root C. It's not really going to matter for this talk, but I would call something that scales like root C still a light operator. Actually, for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to say its scaling is independent of C. Okay, so C goes to infinity with this fixed. Okay, I do want to consider this to be much greater than 1. Okay, but first C goes to infinity first, and then H light
scales. All the operators in your theory are split into these two categories, and
not this. No. Certainly not. So there definitely can be other operators in the theory, but I'm just going to be looking at correlation functions of operators like this. Yeah. All right. And so you know the picture here is that what's going on is the light operators, they don't create a non-trivial background themselves. All they do is they probe the background created by the heavy operators. Okay? Good. So, right, so this is one nice thing about this is now we're looking at things which are not sort of ensembles of states, but we're probing microstates of the geometry, okay? All right, so let me say something very simple about what kind of geometry, what kind of limit this is. So just recall we have scaling dimensions in the CFT correspond to masses in ADS. We also know that the central charge corresponds to 1 over g Newton. All right. So the fact that we're taking the heavy operators to be large with the ratio of a C fixed, right, we're keeping H sub H over C fixed, all right, that translates into the statement that we're keeping G Newton times the heavy mass fixed, and this is just the Schwarzschild radius of the corresponding state, okay? So we're taking a limit where G Newton goes to 0 while the geometry is held fixed, okay? And one thing that's very nice is at this point, we have several technical tools for studying what happens in this limit, okay? All right, so as I said, we're not going to be studying a completely general thing, though it's possible to. We're just gonna look at the simplest possible non-trivial case, which is the case of two lights and two heavies. The two lights are the the same and the two heavies are the same. Okay, so we're going to be looking at this four-point function, O heavy, O light of x, O light of y, and then the state. Okay? So you can think of this as a two-point function in the background created by heavy state, or completely equivalently, you can think of it as a four-point function. Okay? In radial quantization, these are exactly the same thing. Okay? Oops. Let me get this right. Okay? So we can look, so this is a four-point function.
So did you do analytical continuation at some stage?
So you mean in the position x?
So those were real-time correlation functions, right?
We're going to analytically continue back and forth between Euclidean and Lorentzian time.
So all your analysis are in a sort of Euclidean sphere.
It's because we're going to be studying this in terms of a conformal block decomposition. It's true, but actually, once you have things in terms of conformal blocks, you just analytically continue the conformal blocks as a function of the positions, and that's the same decomposition whether it's Euclidean or Lorentzian. The only difference is whether you evaluate the blocks in the Lorentzian regime or the Euclidean regime. I'm not sure if my answer completely satisfied you.
No, I just wanted to make sure.
Okay. So, but yes, it's true. We will be analytically continuing back and forth because some statements will be about the Euclidean regime and some will be about the Lorentzian regime, and we want to be able to study both regimes. All right. So, what are conformal blocks? What's the point? So for an arbitrary correlation function, in this case, we're looking at the four-point function, we can decompose it into conformal blocks. Okay, I'm just going to give some basic intuition of what this is. The exact details are not so important. Suffice it to say that, so we can always conformally map these operators onto the sphere. Okay? So we insert two light operators, and we insert two heavy operators. Okay. So what is the conformal block decomposition? It's just the statement that we can take, the theory. We can look at its state on some ball surrounding the two light operators. Okay, and we can decompose that state into irreducible representations of the conformal group. Okay. So that's all the conformal block decomposition is. We're going to look at irreps of the conformal group on this ball. Okay? All right, and that is what a Virasoro block is, so let me write it more equation-y. So Virasoro conformal blocks, the idea is we just project the four-point function, O heavy, O light, onto an irrep. All right, so I can write that as the block function of some, this is some conformal invariant cross ratio. It's just sum over all states in an irrep of O heavy, alpha, alpha, O light, O light. Okay? That's all it is. I want to emphasize, because sometimes this is a point that gets lost, these are irreps of the four-point function. These are not characters, okay? So the conformal blocks for the four-point function are more general, right? And an important point is that they have an enormous amount of information about gravity. Okay, so let me explain why that is. The basic idea is very simple. As far down as it goes. The basic idea is very simple, and this has to do with why 2D is so powerful, okay? Especially in the context of ADS-CFT. The point is that ADS-3 gravitons, in terms of the conformal algebra, they're just algebraic, okay? Right, so let me say a little bit more about what I mean by that. So remember that gravitons, H mu nu, in ADS are just dual to the stress tensor, T mu nu, right? In fact, not just a single graviton, but actually multi-graviton states are just dual to products of T, okay? And in D equals 2, those are all just elements of the conformal algebra itself. Okay, so the precise statement is that we can decompose T into essentially into its Fourier modes. Okay, and each of these Fourier modes are basically just the Virasoro generators. All right. So this means that the vacuum irrep, or the vacuum block, has a huge amount of knowledge of ADS-3 gravity. So it actually, the irrep that contains the vacuum actually doesn't, obviously doesn't just contain the vacuum, it contains the vacuum plus all possible combinations of ADS-3 multigraviton states. All right? So that means, you know, the vacuum contribution between you and me doesn't just know about exchanging nothing, it knows about exchanging one graviton, which is responsible for the Newtonian potential, it knows about two graviton exchange, three graviton exchange, all possible multigraviton exchanges, and therefore nonlinear resummation all the way up to Einstein's equations, okay? So this actually knows about GR. All right? So actually, we can get a huge amount of information about what's going on just by looking at individual conformal block contributions to these heavy light correlators. All right? So let me say a more precise statement. So I told you it knows about GR. Can we actually see that explicitly in some equations? So let me tell you some results from a 1 over C expansion. And we can see explicitly some of the results from semi-classical GR in this expansion of the vacuum block. Okay, so let me write it like this. So I'll write the vacuum block B vac of T, okay, where Z is now e to the minus T. Okay, so I'm just looking at radial time. What is this? So you can just compute it in this heavy light limit, and it looks like this. Okay, that's the C goes to infinity piece. Then there are corrections to this. So there's 1 over C, and I won't write out the full form because they're extremely messy. We computed them last December, but the exact form of them isn't so important. I just want to point out that they're here, and that you can compute them systematically in a 1 over C expansion, and then 1 over C squared, and so on. Okay, so we know what these functions are. They're sort of complicated, but this is the part of the structure that actually matters. Okay, and this, the point I really want to emphasize is this prefactor sits out in front of everything. And that's manifest when you compute these 1 over C corrections, it's manifest that this piece sits in front of every single term. Why is that important? Okay, so why is it, that prefactor actually contains a lot of physics. So why is that? So, may not be obvious. Some of you will have this memorized by heart, some won't. But the point is pi times th squared over sine squared pi th t. This is a result due to Carty. This is the c equals infinity piece. This is the exactly thermal two-point function. Okay? That is, if you look at O light in a thermal background at infinite radius, that's exactly what you get. Okay? And this this modest little function is sitting inside the conformal blocks. However, this is now not for a thermal background, this is for a pure state. And this guy, in this case, we didn't get it from looking at any kind of thermal arguments. It just followed from the conformal algebra. All right? All we were doing was summing up the contributions from the vacuum irrep. All right? So I haven't told you what th is. Th is a parameter that is given when you do this computation. It's given in terms of the parameters of the block itself, and in particular, it just depends on the dimension of the heavy operator. Okay, and you can translate this into g Newton and the mass of the object, and you can compare it to the corresponding Bekenstein-Hawking entropy for a black hole of the same mass in ADS, and you find it exactly agrees. So this temperature that we derived just from the algebra exactly agrees with the temperature you'd get for the corresponding black hole. So this very heavy, a generic very heavy object, a large central charge, looks like it just creates a thermal background. However, it's not a thermal background, it's an eigenstate. So this is related to something known as eigenstate thermalization. Okay, this is the idea that in a large number, maybe in most systems, if you look at a very energetic eigenstate and you measure it with macroscopic observables, it looks indistinguishable up to very small corrections. It looks indistinguishable from a thermal background. Okay? And so because we're seeing the temperature in a microstate, not in a geometry, what we're seeing is a microscopic derivation of black hole temperature. Okay? Right? We're seeing that a heavy eigenstate actually looks like, when you probe it by these light operators, it actually looks like it creates a thermal background. All right. So, very good. So, what we see is that actually, I've told you about various aspects of semi-classical gravity that are visible just by looking at the blocks. In particular here, we only had to look at the vacuum block at c goes to infinity, okay?
So yes? Just to make sure, say, if you were to compute, say, 16-point function or a 4-point function, is it guaranteed that it will look like the thermal 16-point function with exactly the same value of th?
Yeah, if you just include the vacuum contribution, then it will. You have to, as long as you take the limit c goes to infinity first, so you keep the number 16 fixed and you take c to infinity, then yes.
Why?
What?
Why?
Why?
Yes.
So you can take an arbitrary endpoint function. Mm-hmm. So we have O heavy. You can take an arbitrary endpoint function. You have O light, and you just exchange the vacuum, okay? The easy way to do it, here you can exchange the vacuum with this guy. Then there'll be a vacuum plus some double trace operators, but this is one contribution. The reason is This looks, at large C, this looks exactly like, how do I want to say it? There's a simple way. So actually, the easiest way to do this calculation is to absorb all the contributions of the multi T contributions, to absorb them by doing a change of, by doing a conformal transformation. Okay, and if you do a conformal transformation, you can actually absorb all of them into how do I want to say it? So here's the trick. If you look at so where the block itself is a sum over alpha in all alpha in the irrep of O heavy alpha O light. What are these states? These states are multi-stress tensor states, products of T's, okay? And there's an easy way to do a conformal transformation which kills all of them. So let me start by saying how you do it for O heavy T. The way you do it is you can do a conformal transformation. Let me write it as, how will I write it? Say G goes to E to the 2 sigma G, okay? What you get is there's some Jacobian factor, O heavy prime, which I won't write out explicitly. And then you also get a contribution from the fact that there's an anomaly. Okay? When you do a conformal transformation, the stress tensor doesn't transform just by a Jacobian. It actually gets an expectation value, okay, from the anomaly. You can always choose this conformal transformation in such a way that this cancels against this and you kill this. At large central charge, you just by counting powers of C, you can actually see that you kill all multi-gravitons, all multi-stress tensor contributions as well. So you absorb all of them into this change in metric. Okay. So doing this, as long as it's just this heavy operator, is exactly the same as just doing the vacuum if you didn't include stress tensors and then doing this change. Okay. So that's the reason.
Could I ask, implicitly I think we're saying that the vacuum dominates here.
Yeah.
What guaranteed that?
That's a very good question. So there are two ways to say it. I didn't make this assumption explicitly, but I'm always going to be looking at theories where there are no other conserved currents besides the stress tensor, okay? And I think the cleanest way to state it is if you go very close to the light cone. So then, as long as you go close to the light cone, let me write it like this. So the correlation functions are a function of Z and Z bar. These are just the conformal variant cross ratio and its complex conjugate. Going close to the light cone is taking this to zero, but you get to do anything with Z. And as long as that's true, then conserved currents dominate over everything else. All right. By assumption, the only conserved currents in this theory are the stress tensors and its products. So the vacuum has to dominate in that theory. So any theory without extra conserved currents, that obviously there are theories which have extra conserved currents, right? Anything, for example, a free scalar is going to have additional conserved currents. But at least in this class of theories, there's a very, very simple limit you can look at where the vacuum has to dominate.
And is there a simple interpretation for your first 1 over C correction there?
Not that I know of. Okay. All right. So the point is, semi-classical gravity emerges. That's great. It also means that the information loss that's present in semi-classical gravity also emerges. Okay. So. We can actually see the black hole information paradox at C goes to infinity. Okay? This is great because we know we're working with a unitary CFT, right? We know the final answer has to be unitary, but we can see as we take C to infinity, it looks like it's non-unitary. So there have to be corrections to the C equals infinity limit which restore unitarity, right? And I'll tell you, 1 over C corrections don't do it. So it has to be exponentially small effects. All right. So let me state exactly what the manifestations here of the information paradox are. Okay, so so we have two manifestations of the information paradox. Right. One is what we call forbidden singularities. And these are forbidden singularities in Euclidean time. So this is a Euclidean time problem. So let me tell you what I mean by that. So notice in the answer that I've written down, if you take t to 0, there's obviously a singularity. T goes to 0. That's OK. And that's an OPE singularity. I didn't tell you exactly where the operators were inserted. But as t goes to 0, two of the operators approach each other. And so this is a real physical singularity. It should be there. Okay. It just goes like 1 over t to the 2hl, and this is not only allowed, it's forced on you. That's great, but because of the sign, right, because it looks so much like a thermal background, it actually is periodic in Euclidean time with period related to the temperature. And that's a problem, because that means we don't just have the physical OPE singularity, we get what you can think of as thermal image singularities. Okay. All right. These are not OPE singularities, and therefore they are forbidden by unitarity. Okay. The only singularities that can show up are ones that are associated with operators going close to each other. Okay. All right. So we have to have corrections to this infinite C answer, which remove these forbidden singularities. This is why I wrote this down, because it's manifest that these will not actually resolve the problem. Okay, they're actually, it has to be in the e to the minus C effects. And then the second manifestation, which hopefully I'll have time to talk about, is we still have at late Lorentzian time, we still have late time decay. Yeah. Okay. All right. So that's just take t to it. This sign becomes a cinch. All right, and that goes like an exponential. Okay. Yes.
So far the discussion is very generic. It's for generic,
yes.
For generic CFD. Could you do something something more explicit if you take, say, some minimal CFD and you tensor it lots of times and say get a precise expressions for some of the 4-point correlation functions that you talk. So, or it won't work for some reason.
It's not that it wouldn't work. It's that. We have fewer tools for that kind of question. So yeah, it would be great if we could take some.
In particular, what you might ask is, you have this 1/c corrections, right?
Yeah.
So you say there is a, you know, there can be e to the minus c contributions, or the series in 1/c can be divergent, right?
Yes.
It can be an asymptotic series. So if you would have a more explicit example, it would be nice to see.
Those are sort of the same statement. Right?
Yeah,
the fact that a 1 over c,
right.
So actually I would call this the same solution. The 1 over c expansion
right.
is asymptotic. If you were to Borel resum it or something, you would see that. So there's a tight connection between the perturbative expansion and the e to the minus c effects.
Do you have a CFT where I can actually do the computation? And
I wish. No, we don't.
So why is the tensor product of minimal models doesn't work?
Oh, why is the tensor product of minimal models? Because it has extra conserved currents. So remember, this wasn't completely generic, right? You can't have extra conserved
that
currents.
That goes back to the question about vacuum dominance.
Yeah, that's right.
Is an independent, simple, fast argument why 1/c expansion should be equal to, like for QED, one said that they change the sign squared minus.
That's an interesting question. If c goes to minus c, is there some dynamical thing that
It's not c to minus c because
yeah. I mean, at this point, the way I think about it is, if you know that there are other saddles out there, then those should show up as the fact that the perturbative expansion is asymptotic, and so. But no, it's an interesting question. Yeah, that would be nice if you could say something about why. Let me think about it. There might actually be a nice way to say that negative C large something should blow up in your face, but I don't have anything sharp to say right now. And I'm getting shorter on time. So let me talk about E to the minus C effects in conformal blocks. And their relation to unitarity restoration. Okay? So here I'm just going to summarize. I'm not going to say much about the technique, but I'll summarize. So it turns out that it's possible to compute these E minus C effects. The idea is very simple. It's that there are special, what are called degenerate values of the external dimensions. In this case, H heavy. There's some specific choices corresponding to these two indices, R and S, where these operators become degenerate operators, where there's some shortening condition. Okay, if you look at the descendants in the irrep, some of the states in the irrep become null, and that leads to differential equations, which the correlators have to satisfy. Okay, so you satisfy differential equations. I think one of the reasons why this hasn't been used so much for C large is because you might have thought at C greater than 1, there's no way this can work for telling you something about unitarity restoration, because when C is greater than 1, these dimensions are less than 0. And so we were putting in some non-unitarity from the very beginning. So how are you ever going to use that to understand resolution of unitarity? So it's not as bad as it sounds. And let me give you the basic idea why. It's because if you look at these differential equations near any forbidden singularity, they become very simple. Okay? So let me take t is equal to n over th plus tau. Tau is small. Okay? So then the differential equation that you get takes the form 0 is approximately equal to, so I'll just write it out, it's not so long. Before you take the tau small limit, it looks quite scary, but afterwards, it's not so bad. Okay? All right. So that's something that even I know how to solve. You can write it in the following way. You can write it as a special function, or you can write it as an integral equation. The integral equation is a little bit more useful, since you can just stare at it and see what's happening, and it looks like this. Okay? All right, so the key point about this is let's look at t near one of these forbidden singularities. Okay? In the limit that c goes to infinity, there's a singularity. Okay? You can just see, take c to infinity, this term drops out. Right, and you get a 1 over t to the 2h. However, when you turn finite c on, the singularity gets resolved. There's actually now some finite width to this. Okay, so this is this is what I'll call perturbation theory. This is what I'll call what the exact answer looks like, and there's some width associated with this. Which is sigma n over root c. Okay, so you can actually see that sort of non-perturbative effects are resolving this when you know the answer exactly. We can take this, we can series expand it in large C. Okay, and it has terms like this. Here is the 1 over C terms, okay? And these are the terms that are visible in perturbation theory in 1 over C. And then it has additional terms, which are not, okay? Okay, and here you have some function of tau. And it has its own, each non-perturbative piece has its own set of perturbative expansions around it. So this is the non-perturbative piece. Okay? And here's where we can win by computing this function for all possible values of S. Okay, we get it as a function of H, and now there's an assumption involved that analytic continuation is the right thing to do, but we can analytically continue it away from the degenerate operator values, okay? So this function is very complicated in general, but let me just say what it looks like in the limit that H1S is much greater than C. In that case, it's fairly simple, so sigma n, and now I'm gonna write it as sigma n of H heavy, since I want to analytically continue this. This looks like C over 6 H heavy, integral from 0 to 2 pi n, dt over t, sine squared t. The exact form is not so important. The point is I just want to say that this started off life as one of the degenerate operator values, and now we're getting it for unitary values by analytic continuation. Okay. All right. So this is an explicit calculation of how non-perturbatively small effects actually resolve the loss of unitarity in perturbation theory in 1 over C. Yes?
So
this computation, non-perturbative effects, is still in a probe approximation when you neglect the back reaction of this light insertion, right? At some stage you should.
Yeah. I mean,
you should worry once you reach this periodicity in Euclidean time, right? So maybe the back reaction is already.
Yeah. That's right. The back reaction is included by. It's just that they're small. So there's these H light over C terms. Okay. But yeah, they're part of this. It's just that.
So is there any geometric interpretation of this?
Yes. That's a great question. That's sort of what I want to talk about in the last 2 minutes of my talk. So what I want to say is that these are related to additional. I want to say that these seem like they're different geometries that you can fill ADS in with. Okay, so you can fill it in with one geometry, but you could fill it in with other geometries. So let me. That statement is more vague. We don't have. That didn't work. We don't have a proof of that statement. But let me tell you what we do know and why it looks very much like from. Understanding the blocks, you can start to understand what other geometries are contributing non-perturbatively. Okay, so the idea is if someone did come and hand you sort of an action for gravity, and they also told you, here are the rules for computing and making sense of all saddle points that contribute to that action, right? So right now we don't know what the rules are for what those things are, but say someone came and handed you that, then you could just go out, you could compute what all the different saddles are. There'd be one, which is the usual semi-classical answer, and there'd be other ones that you'd have to include, and there would be these guys. So that is, that's the hope. Let me tell you what we actually can say about it right now, and I'll just summarize it. So the point is, we actually do know a lot about what these extra contributions look like. So we put out a paper Sunday night. And the point is, so far I've been talking about, is it gone? The perturbative expansion, which I'll write like this. Okay, this is the 1 over C perturbative expansion to the block. And you can think of this as sort of what you might call the leading saddle. Okay, this is the contribution from a solution to the equations of motion, assuming you had such had a Lagrangian for that you knew how to make sense of. But there are infinite number of other things, okay? And they look like this. Okay? So there's a sum over. So this is just, let me emphasize, this is a single block. This is just all of these contributions are in the same vacuum block. This is the leading contribution, but then there are infinite number of other guys. Okay, and they have their own expansion. Okay. Now, these are hard to study in general. We still don't know how to get them. But these can actually all be studied using a method that's been around for a while. If it's called the monodromy method, if you know what that means. If you don't worry about it. But the point is, it's a way of actually calculating what these things are. Okay. So that was what the paper on Sunday was all about, was analyzing how these guys behave at late times, at late Lorentzian time. All right, and the result is very simple to state. There's an infinite number of these contributions. In some cases, there's a truncation. There are a finite number of them, but generically, there's an infinite number. And so there are two classes of saddles. So there's the first class, which I'll call decaying. These are ones which, over here, these are ones which at late times decay exponentially. Okay? And this always includes the leading saddle. Okay? And there's another class, which we call oscillating, and they don't decay at late times. Okay? So they do something like this. And then the oscillations die down at late times. Okay? So it looks like they approach some constant value. Okay? All right, so the idea, the hope, is that these are responsible for information not for the correlators not decaying all the way to zero at late times. All right, so we can't, strictly speaking, say we know they're there because we have no idea what these guys are. Technically, it's possible that all these terms are zero. I think that's unlikely, but we can't prove it. Okay, but so that's the idea, is that there's an infinite number of these guys. The fact that you know them, I think, that we have, you know, that we're able to compute them, and we have these methods for learning, I think, is very powerful because this actually tells you a lot about. If you're trying to make sense of a gravity action, this tells you a lot about what you would expect the geometries that fill in ADS to be, right? You can actually just read off, in some sense, what the metric is, because let me just say, it's because you can learn what the stress tensor corresponding to each of these guys is, that tells you a lot about the geometry in ADS, what it would be. All right.
But the distinction is about behavior of this function f and the exponent, or?
This we know.
Yeah.
And this we don't know.
And it's late time asymptotics of this function f which determines the distinction between.
Yes, that's right.
But for the vacuum one, kind of, there is no f, right? All what it is there is kind of what you don't know, and that is decaying on its own.
The vacuum one also has these guys as well. Okay. So this, the leading saddle in the vacuum one is what decays exponentially.
No, sorry, I meant leading saddle. So leading saddle doesn't have f. So it's only have G things and it's decaying
exponentially, right? So it's because of the way I wrote it. So it would have been more accurate to write this as e to the minus c over 6 f0 of t.
Okay.
So, but I cheated a little bit to make it look simpler than it was.
Okay.
All right, so that's basically it. I was going to say some sort of motivating things about future directions, but let me just say that I think this has the potential to teach us a lot about ADS through gravity, and that's it. Thanks. Yes.
Just to clarify, so the graphs you drew were for fp of t or e to the minus fp of t?
E to the minus fp of t.
So how do you know if you have infinitely many of them that they won't sum into some really weird thing and like blow up or something like that?
You don't.
You don't. And do you expect any particular behavior other than the just generic spike oscillations in at late time?
What the sum of them is? No, I think it's an interesting question. So, you know, actually starting to sum up all of these saddles instead of just looking at one at a time goes beyond what we've been able to do. Okay, but that that would be great.
So, what's your gravity interpretation of this behavior?
Okay, so the gravity interpretation of this is that each of these, so this is the idea. The gravity interpretation is someone tells you what your equations of motion are, so they hand you an action for, probably the way to make sense of it is going to be some Chern-Simons action for gravity, okay? And they tell you what the equations of motion are for this. And then you look at all the solutions to this, you find all of them. One of those solutions is the semi-classical solution, which gives you standard GR, but there'll be other ones. And those other ones are going to take ADS, and instead of filling it up in with BTZ, they'll fill it in with something funny, something different, which is responsible for the part that doesn't decay.
One is singular metric?
Why Chern-Simons is important?
Why is Chern-Simons important? Maybe it's not. It just seems like it's. I'm maybe more optimistic about making sense of that formulation of gravity. Partly, I can say a little bit more about it. So, part of it is you can formulate contributions in the Chern-Simons gravity very easily as contributions from Wilson lines, and we already know. Let me just make one statement because this is already sort of getting into just vague hand waving, but we do actually know because of work by Per Kraus, Perlmutter, Snively, and Hijano how to make sense of how to compute the conformal block in semi-classical gravity. And the way that works is you compute, you do the sort of usual computation you would for a Witten diagram, except instead of integrating the bulk to boundary propagator over all space, you just integrate it along a geodesic. Okay. And so the idea is more generally you could formulate a non-perturbative extension of that by having Wilson lines associated with each of the geodesics. Okay. Yes?
So all the stuff you did to define this completely decaying portion, you said that it relied on the fact that T was your only conserved current in the theory?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you had started having some other conserved currents, can you think if there is a way to throw in other conserved currents that would preserve?
Yeah, you can get, so the simplest one is just add in a U1 abelian current. You actually, it's straightforward to compute what the blocks look like when you include that, because basically all they do is they shift the stress tensor, they give a contribution which is the Sugawara stress tensor, and so you can compute the new blocks which include not just T's but also J's, and if the charge of, if the charge of your external states is large enough, you actually can get rid of the singularity. Okay. So it's adding in additional conserved currents doesn't just, it's not just something that makes it hard to prove it. It actually can really change the answer.
No, but I was saying, can you also add in extra conserved currents in a way that doesn't change?
Oh.
Because I'm thinking of how this relates back to the gravity picture, you're obviously going to have some other conserved currents in our semi-classical curve.
Well, I think, yeah, so if you add an additional conserved currents, then usually it will change the answer, but it might change it qualitatively or it might not change it qualitatively. So you can look at examples where both things happen.
Thank you very much.